Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Independent journalist Mohammed Omar says the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is worsening by the hour. Israel is targeting the civilian population, and there is nowhere to run. At least 21 Palestinians have been killed, including 5 children. And on Thursday, 3 Israelis were killed by rockets in the south. Those rockets have since reached Tel Aviv. On Wednesday, Israeli forces assassinated Hamas military chief Ahmed al-Jabari and then launched a flurry of airstrikes, which continue. Joining us to talk about what is happening on the ground is Mohammed Omar. He has reported for a number of news outlets, including The Washington Post, The Nation, and Al Jazeera. And he joins us from the Gaza Strip. Hi, Mohammed. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And I want to let listeners know Mohammed will be with us for the next 20 minutes, and hopefully his line will stay clear. So if you have any comments or questions about media coverage, this has been getting front page news over the past few days. What's really struck you about media coverage? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So Mohammed, things are changing so quickly. Give us the latest. Where are you right now and what is happening?
Oh, I just got back from the Khan Yunis in the middle of the Gaza Strip. I'm right now at Rafah refugee camp in the south, far south of the Gaza Strip, border with Egypt. The situation is deteriorating at the moment. The number of people who are, let me start first with the number of airstrikes that have been launched by Israeli missiles, or Israeli drones and F-16s. There is about 508 airstrikes in the last 3 days. The number of people who were killed is 23. Among them, there is 8 children, 2 women, and 2 elderly people. There is about 48 people who were injured. Among them, there is 148 women and the children. This is a very intense period for the people in Gaza. Israel is targeting the population of the Gazans. Life is getting to be very difficult as we go along. The border crossings have been mostly closed. Rafah crossing has been open today. Kerem Shalom has been closed. Erez crossing is closed, even for humanitarian cases. The number of houses that were demolished is about 12 that were completely demolished. 150 houses were partially demolished, including mosques, roads, schools, and farmlands. As I speak to you, the Israeli F-16s are still firing missiles on the southern part of the Gaza Strip and the northern part of the Gaza Strip, the eastern part of the Gaza Strip. There is also more tank shells that are being fired from Al Zaytun area in the east of Gaza City. There is as it seems, a military buildup in the east of Gaza City and the east of Rafah and Khan Yunis. Israel has been talking about a large-scale ground attack on the Gaza Strip. This seems to be the case for tonight. Many people are quite scared that this is going to be the case. I should say also that Israel is targeting civilians. It's like shooting a fish in a bowl, basically. And there is no way for people to run. Unlike Tel Aviv and the Israeli cities, there is no shelter. There is nowhere to hide for the population in the Gaza Strip. People cannot even sleep in their own bedrooms because they're afraid that when they sleep in their own bedrooms, that the windows are going to fall off on their head. Humanitarian situation is again deteriorating. There is a talk by Shifa Hospital. There is 192 types of medicines that are not in the stocks of the Ministry of Health, that they are not available at the Gaza hospitals. There is 450 items of medical supplies that are known as disposable medical items. They are not available anymore. There is a call from the Shifa Hospital and from all the local hospitals in the Gaza Strip for the Palestinian Authority and for the international community to provide aid and medical supplies to the hospitals in the Gaza Strip in order to face the crisis.
And Mohammed, the context is really missing from a lot of the media coverage. I mean, things in the Gaza Strip were bad before this happened, right? Just in terms of access to hospitals, the humanitarian situation, food, poverty, you know, all of these things are really missing from so much of the coverage. How important is that?
Oh, that's very important to add a context. I haven't added a context when I started it, so I should add the context. It depends how far you want to go. The siege started basically when Hamas won the elections back in 2006, where Israel decided to cut every possibility on the Palestinian government, which is democratically elected, that is Hamas. And by this, there was the blockade where border closed, where border crossings were controlled by Israel. Israel closed the Gaza Strip, make it impossible for people to move in and out. And there was also the shortages of medical supplies, shortages of fuel as well, shortages of food, and even the shortages of electricity. There was shortages of all sorts of everything that you can imagine to make life possible in the Gaza Strip. This is started in 2006 and is still continuing until today, even though there is now and then an opening by the Israeli authorities to ease the life of the Palestinians. Well, that was the case. There was even a study lately that Israeli army, they were studying how much calories the average Gazans need per day in order to calculate what is the need of the Gaza Strip. Gaza is living in a very dire economic situation as a result of the siege, and unemployment has reached the level of more than 70%. 80% of the population in the Gaza Strip rely on aid provided by the United Nations and other UN agencies. I should say also, if you want to bring it more to November, there was a ceasefire where Israel had agreed to comply. Unfortunately, Israel broke the ceasefire on the 7th of November by killing a 12-year-old boy who was playing soccer in the street of Gaza. And again, the ceasefire was provoked by Israel when the Israeli armed drones and F-16s fired missiles on Ahmed al-Jabri, the Hamas senior military leader. This has caused all this retaliation from the Palestinian side and firing rockets from the Gaza Strip. Some of these rockets were fired, and for the very first time since 1991, these rockets were able to reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, which caused panic also in the Israeli community and cities.
Right. And Mohammed, I wanted to ask you about this. We're speaking with Mohammed Omar, independent journalist joining us from Gaza. And you just talked about the timeline. The Institute of Middle East Understanding published a timeline of what has happened in recent weeks. And what you're getting in the media, most of the national media in the U.S., is that Israel is responding to Palestinian rocket fire. Those are most of the headlines that we're seeing. A lot of the stories start off with that. Can you talk about that narrative and then talk about why it's so important to include what has happened over the last couple of weeks in these articles for context? And do you find that media outlets are fact-checking the stories? Are you hearing from journalists in Gaza who are inquiring about what has happened over the past few weeks?
Well, let me start with the this. You know, actually, it's not the Palestinians who are firing rockets. It's the occupation which is the problem here. It is the occupation which is controlling the life of people. It's the occupation which makes people starve. It's the occupation which makes life impossible. It's the occupation which takes away education opportunities by not allowing young people to go outside and to have opportunities to meet with their future demands. It's the occupation which did not allow the students to move between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank in order to join universities. It's the Israeli occupation which does not allow the patients to go to hospitals. It is the Israeli occupation which bombed and maimed the people in the Gaza Strip and terrorized 24/7. This is also the result of a continuous, a very long-term oppression caused by the presence of the Israeli occupation. And it has been going on for that long that the Palestinians are frustrated. Well, as I speak to you right now, I don't know if you hear right now, the F-16s are firing just a missile just right now like as we are speaking. We don't know where is the target exactly, but this is continuing. I mean, look who started all this. It is the Israeli occupation who started to enforce the blockade on the Gaza Strip and make life impossible for the people who are living in the Gaza Strip. What do you imagine? What do you expect from someone who's living in a very dire situation, a father of seven, who's not able to feed them? Simply because Israel is blocking every way. He's not able to go to work in the West Bank or to travel. He's not able to get construction materials in order to build in the Gaza Strip. Still, houses that were demolished in Operation Castlet in 2008, 2009 are still ruins. They are not being built. Even though with the promises of the visit of the Emir of Qatar to construct Gaza and to help rebuild the Gaza Strip, still Israel is not allowing construction materials. It is the occupation who caused all these problems. And regarding the provoking, who is the one who is causing all this trouble? It is the occupying power, which occupied people's land and dragged them out of their bedrooms in the middle of the night with their pajamas while they are sleeping to take them to the Israeli prisons. It is the occupation who terrorized a nation of people who have nothing, but they're just staying in their homes. Of course, there is the reaction from the Hamas and the other factions, and they are retaliating against what's happening. And this is nothing new. The retaliation is taking place.
And Mohammed, we have a few phone calls, so I want to get to a few phone calls because I know we have to let you go soon. We're speaking with Mohammed Omar. He reports for outlets including The Washington Post, The Nation, and Al Jazeera. And let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Hi, good morning. Actually, the media have done a better job this time, especially NPR and a few others.
What have you noticed, Eid? What's different?
I noticed that they're reporting more that, you know, Israel is more aggressive this time than before, and few of them are blaming the Palestinian rockets. But what I'm really, really disappointed at is Obama himself, after all of the work we've done, he always mentioned that, you know, the Israeli children being in danger, never mentioned the Palestinian, and his secretary Rice this morning, whatever she said was awful, not also his secretary of the news secretary. I also like to bring a very personal thing very, very quickly. In 1956, I was riding my bicycle, tiny boy, in the streets of Cairo when Israel, England and France were bombing us. All of a sudden, I had three airplanes over my head, and I couldn't run fast enough to find some place to hide. I lived through that. It is awful. This is awful. Not really. The time is not on the side of Israel at all. What Israel is doing is just terminating its existence as a civilized nation. And Obama should be ashamed of himself after all of the work we've done to have these speeches by Rice and others today.
Well, thank you for the comment, Eid. Just a number of headlines. Susan Rice defends Israel at the UN Security Council. Susan Rice asserts right of Israel to aggressively defend itself. U.S. defends Israeli attacks on Gaza at UN. These are just a number of the headlines. The Washington Post, UN says relief. Oh, that's a different post about a child that was killed. This is actually getting a lot of attention because a child of a BBC journalist was killed, and that picture was on the front page of the Washington Post, and you can see that at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
It's undeniable that Israel's treatment of Palestine and the Palestinian people over the years has been reprehensible and untenable, but that said, there seems to be a tendency to paint Israel as the sole aggressor, and I can't help but wonder that when the Palestinians elected to run their country, a terrorist group that is sworn to wipe Israel off the map, I mean, did nobody see this coming? Has this not been coming down the pike for 6 years? The situation is a little more complex, I think, sometimes than how it's painted. I mean, both sides have a significant amount of blood on their hands. I would not wish any of this on anybody on either side, but Israel is not the only one at fault here.
Mohammed, were you able to hear Mike?
Yes.
And what's your what's your response?
I mean, it depends. How do you define terrorism, really, to start with? How do you define what's terrorism to start with? And who defines that Palestinians voting for a terrorist group, as you say? Who said that this is a terrorist group? Wasn't Nelson Mandela also recognized as a terrorist?
All All right. Well, is that your response to Mike? I mean, this is actually for another conversation for a show about this issue. But what we really wanted to do is talk about media coverage of what's happening. Mohammed, before we let you go, there is a lot of outlets are talking about a possible ground invasion. What are you hearing about that?
I mean, the only thing I hear about that is the military buildup, which we can hear now and then on the borderline, particularly in the east of Gaza City, Shizaiya, and on the southern part of the Gaza Strip, to the east of Khan Yunis and to the east of Rafah. There is a military buildup, and more and more of those bulldozers and tanks are gathering. We don't know when it's going to start and if it's starting. The fact that the army or the Israeli authorities called 30,000 soldiers for their work, and this is a rather important indication that something is coming up. We don't know if this is going to happen tonight or tomorrow, but every now and then we hear a number of the bulldozers and tanks gathering in unusual military buildup on the borderline.
And also, in 2006, the main power plant was destroyed in Gaza. The Electronic Frontier Foundation tweeted last night that Israel is threatening to shut off the internet in Gaza, and they provided instructions for configuring dial-up connections. Do you still have access to the internet, and do you know if that might be shut down?
I still have access to the internet. I mean, it's pretty easy for the Israeli government to disconnect the Gaza Strip from the world. It happened just last year when an Israeli bulldozer demolished the fiber lines that connects the Gaza Strip with the world by disconnecting the cables under the ground. This is something that is happening, and it's potential that it's going to happen. But then you are going to cut off a lot of the journalists and the news agencies who are reporting from the Gaza Strip. You're going to cut off all the services by the International Red Cross and the different humanitarian organizations, including all the branches of the United Nations. And if this is happening, I don't know what's going to happen, but, well, nothing is impossible. It's possible, and I've seen some of these tweets that which I find rather suspicious of people spreading information, preparing the Gazans to do different ways of dial-up. I don't know. I don't use that. And if there is no dial-up in Gaza, then there is no dial-up. I don't expect someone to come from the moon and to give me a dial-up, because those people are quite suspicious. And they are actually, a lot of this in the media, I should say, as much as I like social media, I find it's rather scary, because a lot of the information out there needs to be really filtered and carefully taken by the media.
Right.
The media is just taking some of this information and say, well, this number of people were killed, and then we go and they check the facts and it's not accurate. It's because there are people, I don't know what's their agendas, they're trying to destroy the narrative of the Palestinian story by bringing rather confusing stories, which makes the average person who's following in the forum on Twitter quite confused and not able to follow up what is exactly happening on the ground.
Well, Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure we will do a show on this and we'll follow it in the coming weeks. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That is Mohammed Omar. He has reported for a number of outlets, including The Washington Post, The Nation, and Al Jazeera, and he's been joining us from Gaza. He says over the past 3 days, they have had 508 airstrikes, 23 Palestinians have been killed, including 8 children, and 3 Israelis were killed on Thursday by rockets in the south, and rockets have since reached Tel Aviv, and we will continue following this. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we are going to switch gears now and talk about media coverage of the new cap and trade program in California. Under this new law, owners of refineries, power plants, and factories must buy and sell permits to emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And this cap and trade plan is a central piece of AB 32, the state's landmark 2006 global warming regulations. David Baker has been covering this for the San Francisco Chronicle. If you've read the Chronicle over the past few days, you've probably seen David's pieces. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show. And we are also joined by Mark Shapiro, investigative journalist who specializes in environmental stories. He's done extensive reporting on this for the Center for Investigative Reporting. His work has appeared in a number of publications, including Harper's, The Nation, and Mother Jones. Hi, Mark. Welcome back.
Hi, good morning.
So before we start, I want to ask you both what you saw this week that you thought was done well. We always give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see, Mark?
Well, I think this is actually more in the last month, and I have to just say something about how surreal it can be just hearing the news straight from Gaza now suddenly here talking about AB 32.
Yeah,
but the world is complicated and big, but I'll acknowledge that for the moment.
Thank you.
I think I would actually say that in the recent issue, I found a really strikingly very well-written story and very evocative. Actually, was in Mother Jones in the current issue, November, December, written by Shane Bauer, who some people might remember, was actually arrested on the Iranian-Iraq border and was released some months ago, a journalist, I think a local journalist. I've never met him, but I think he's based in the Bay Area.
We had him on to talk about this piece a few weeks ago.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I didn't know that.
Now
I'm going to actually, because I think he did a great job, not just from the point of view. What he did was he described, and he was able to kind of pivot between his own experience of being in isolation in an Iranian prison, solitary confinement, to the experience of people who go through solitary confinement in the United States. And what I liked about it, number one, was it bringing, obviously, his own experience to bear in Iran. But he did not go for kind of an easy kind of moral equivalence, which, because the United States is obviously not like Iran, nor does he attempt to make any kind of fatuous comparisons, but he does evoke very powerfully the experience of sort of going through solitary confinement, how isolating it is, and then talks about that for American prisoners. So it's a very powerful piece.
Yes, so kudos to Shane Bauer. I want to give kudos, since you brought that up, to Nancy Mullane, who's a reporter with KLW News. She's been doing amazing reporting from San Quentin and these prisons that we have not heard about, simply because they are so far away from large cities. So we don't have to see these prisons. And she's talking to prisoners who've never met reporters before. And she's just done amazing work. And it's always captivating. So thank you. You just brought that up in my mind.
Yes. And actually, you're right, because I have heard some of those dispatches. They are very powerful.
And David, just quickly before we go to break.
Well, I think the thing that most struck me in the last couple of weeks, the piece that most struck me, is a fairly short one that was in last weekend's New York Times Magazine. And it was looking at economic transformation of a particular stretch of Broadway and 29th Street in Manhattan, and sort of showing how a couple of different forces in the modern economy are playing out there. On one end, you have the people who've been in that area for a long time, which are basically wholesalers of very cheap jewelry and electronic goods and that kind of stuff, who sell their wares to people at other stores around New York. But also they sell to people who come to New York from Africa and from other countries around the world and buy up a bunch of this stuff, take it home, and sell it there.
Hmm.
They're the sort of the original population of businesses on that street. And now you have some other more high-end people moving in, like there's a hotel that caters very much to tech workers who fly around the globe with their wireless and deal with each other. Usually face-to-face a little bit, but mostly over the Internet.
And we're going to take just a quick break. We'll put these links at yourcallradio.org, and we'll be back right after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Weekly Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org, and you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. And coming up on Monday, We will talk about what Superstorm Sandy has revealed about relief efforts. Tens of thousands of residents at the end of subway lines are still in dire need of help. So what role has the city government played? What role has FEMA played? And then also, what about Occupy Sandy? They've done amazing work in Brooklyn and Red Hook and so many places that really are in dire need of help. And we'll talk about what we can learn here in earthquake country from what's happening in New York and New Jersey. That's on Monday. Also, we'll talk about the best organizations to support. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's our media roundtable today, and now we are talking about media coverage of California's brand new cap and trade program. David Baker, a staff writer with the Chronicle, has been extensively writing about this in the paper. You can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Mark Shapiro has also extensively written about this for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's also done a lot of reporting on climate change. And so, David, before we jump in, we actually have a call on this. Before we take our caller, why don't you just give us an overview of this cap and trade program, which is a central piece of AB 32, California's landmark 2006 global warming regulations.
Yeah, the basic idea of it is you try to put a price on carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. You set up a market that is going to put a price on releasing those greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is something that we as a country just haven't been willing to do in the past. You've always been able to emit this stuff for free. So in this market, there are going to be permits to release greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Permits are called allowances. The state basically dishes them out to some companies. Other companies have to buy most of theirs. And then it creates this market whereby the companies can trade them back and forth amongst themselves. So if you're a company that's able to cut your emissions pretty quickly, you can sell your spare allowances to other companies that either can't or won't cut theirs as fast. And at the same time, the state puts an overall limit on the amount of carbon dioxide that our economy can churn out. And that limit is going to go down bit by bit, year by year.
Okay, so can you paint us a picture from the company to the emissions and then how it works from there?
Company to the emissions. Well, say you're a manufacturing plant. You have your own basic sources of energy. You've got some kind of heat-generating thing that you're going to be drawing off of. You are pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So basically what's going to happen is you have, for the last couple of years, been under state orders to count your emissions, and they have a process set up for doing that. You're going to be dealing with regulators at the state who are going to say, okay, here's the typical annual emissions for your kind of factory. We will give you enough allowances to cover about 90% of that. The other 10% you have to go out and buy. So you get those, and if you can cut your emissions down to the point where you don't need to buy allowances, great. Otherwise, you have to go into the market and get them. And as I say, bit by bit, the top level, the most that you can emit without having to go out and buy more, that will go down a little bit every year from here on out.
And Mark, how significant is this now that this is going into effect?
First of all, I mean, it's hugely significant. And David Baker just gave a very clear explanation of how it works. And I think actually to understand where the California thing fits in the world, the key thing to understand is like back in the 1990s when the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated, the big struggle there was David Baker is absolutely right. The emissions of carbon dioxide have essentially been free. But they've been free to, but they haven't really been free, because the costs from the emissions of fossil fuel emissions comes to us, the society. It's borne by taxpayers. It's borne. We're seeing it now with the effects of the heat, of the radically changing temperature. These are costs that are borne down the line by society. So the effort here is to essentially begin paying those costs up front as a way to incentivize less fossil fuel intensive energy use. In terms of, this is a huge development in the United States. Of course, California now way at the front of the United States. This was supposed to be done in coordination with the United States government itself on a federal level. That effort was unable to make it through the Republican Congress a couple of years ago. So now California is by far The most pursuing limits on greenhouse gas emissions far in advance of any other state in the country, and is approximating, beginning to approximate, although not quite yet, but ultimately will if it keeps moving forward, that those efforts of the European Union and other areas that have actually signed the Kyoto Protocol. Hugely significant development in the United States.
And how has this worked in Europe?
Well, that's another question. So on the one hand, we want to acknowledge what a hugely historic moment this is in California, in the United States. In Europe, which has a cap and trade system very similar to the one that we now have in the United in California, there have really been a lot of questions as to how effective it's actually been. It really depends on the study you look at to actually figure out whether the whether this has actually led to emission reductions by the major polluters. I would say the one key thing that I think is indisputable in Europe is that the idea of putting a price on carbon emissions has, in fact, triggered huge amounts of incentives in the broader economy. So you have the development of kind of low energy intensive technologies across the board, the proliferation of things like solar power and wind power in places like Germany and Scandinavia, huge proliferation of this kind of technology, partly spurred by the existence of the cap and trade system in Europe. So the question, and plus to keep an eye out for in this state, as it is globally, are two things. One, does the market mechanisms itself lead to reduced emissions? I think it's there are still questions as to whether there are direct relations between the market and reduced emissions. Secondly, though, the spur to innovation on other levels has I think been pretty clear, and I think that's what Jerry Brown and that's what Schwarzenegger when he launched this are banking on, essentially, is the trigger that this provides to innovation.
Well, we have a call on this, and if you'd like to weigh in on this cap-and-trade program, are you seeing coverage? It's getting national attention, actually, but it's treated mainly as a California story. Why is that? Why isn't it being treated as a global warming or climate change story? And if you saw anything else this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Susan in Oakland. Hi, Susan. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm concerned about the reporting I've seen on this seems to completely neglect the effect on lower-income people. And there are a number of problems here. One is the possibility that the tax is quite regressive. I mean, I've seen different arguments of sometimes, you know, some states, it's some countries, it can be quite heavy. And that's a factor that I have not seen addressed. I haven't heard people talking about other ways that these things could be done or if they could be done more slowly. And then there's the
On that note, why don't you hold the line, and then why don't we get David and Mark to respond, and then you can come back with your second question. David, what are your thoughts on that?
That's an absolutely excellent question. I mean, you know, this is not described as a tax by the state, and they're doing that for legal reasons in part. But it is almost certainly going to add to energy costs, you know, how much you pay for gas, how much you pay for electricity. Now, on the electricity end of that thing, there is supposed to be a mechanism set up whereby the extra cost that you're paying, you know, for every kilowatt hour of electricity you use actually gets refunded back to you, in a sense, by the utilities. The money that the utilities are going to make from auctioning off their initial permits is supposed to go back to you, the ratepayer. They still haven't figured out exactly how to do that, however, even though they just launched this market. The California Public Utilities Commission is supposed to issue a proposal on that sometime in the next few weeks, but they haven't done it yet. The other side of that, the gasoline side, is a lot murkier. I don't yet know of a way that the state is going to more or less compensate people for the additional cost that they're facing there, although that is something that's very much under discussion in Sacramento.
Anything to add, Mark?
No, I think that pretty much addresses the question. I mean, I think there is no question that this is going to create an incremental and steadily increasing rise in prices of energy. And the only way to understand that in the big picture, because there's no question that the higher percentages of income and lower income people, this is going to hit. I mean, it hits all of us equally. And but I think the only way to understand that in the big picture is that we've been paying an artificially low price for energy until this time. And now we're going to begin paying a price that actually resembles its cost.
Can you elaborate on that? Because this doesn't really get much attention. People are outraged by high gas prices. They're outraged by their PG&E bill. But these are actually pretty low prices compared to other countries.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Very low.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we pay extraordinarily low prices relative to other countries when it comes to energy. And one of the key reasons for that is that consequences of our energy use, which we're now seeing in the form of climate change, which disrupts climactic patterns, which is affecting food growing, which helps create more extreme weather events that causes billions and billions and billions of dollars in expenses, is not reflected in the actual cost of energy. Many other countries, for example, either have a higher cost to begin with or have taxes that actually are used to mitigate the effects of fossil fuel usage. So we have to, these are, in economic terms, are called the externalized costs. But let's not pretend what externalized costs are. Externalized costs ultimately land on all of us, meaning taxpayers down the line, which enables utilities to actually offer cheaper cheaper costs of electricity at the front end because the rest of us pay the prices at the back end. And I think the effort of the California and the whole cap and trade system is to begin to start paying more of those costs up front, to give a more accurate cost profit-cost dynamic.
And then, you know, at the same time, though, I feel the same way on that, and I've often said the same thing to readers, and yet I think it's important for us also to remember that even though that's true, if you're a low-income household, especially if you're low-income in a rural area where you don't have access to mass transit, this is going to hurt. You know, you are used to paying a certain amount for gas and for electricity, and when those go up, you don't really have much choice but to pay it. So, yes, this is finally pricing in things that should be priced in, but it's going to be painful for
and
some people.
And where does that money go?
Well, that's the amazing thing with this. They have launched this market without actually clearly stating exactly where the money is going. Some of it, the stuff that basically goes through the utilities, how much they're from their allowances, that is supposed to go back, by and large, to you, the ratepayers. But the other stuff, like if you're the money coming from factories buying allowances, that's going through the state government, and they have not yet set up exactly the system for using it. It's supposed to be used mostly for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but they haven't actually set up the system yet.
Susan, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm very concerned about this. For one thing, you people are not talking about the issue of employment. When I say low-income people, I mean, for example, the story that was told in Mother Jones. They had a tomato sauce factory, and they didn't even mention how many people worked there. We're talking about 500 to 1,000 people. I had to look it up. And this is a lot of people who, if you put a $250,000 tax on this firm, these people could be put out of work. It also means that the price of processed food is going up. And we're talking about California, where there's a very high unemployment rate. And to impose extra taxes and higher rates of unemployment seems extraordinarily heartless, and I do not see why this is not more discussed. Similarly, you know, you say you're talking about policies to return things to people, but these need to be discussed, whereas Marketplace, the discussion that they gave, was just, oh, how wonderful. You know, you need to be more critical. There has to be more discussion of the people who are going to lose jobs. You know, the whole food processing industry, which is a big industry in California, and it's a lot of low-income people, and you're going to hurt them.
Well,
Mark,
I'm not quite sure about all the details of things you've referred to there, and I certainly sympathize with people for whom this is going to cost, including myself, by the way. It's not like some abstract notion. I mean, I would also say, to have a little bit of a cautionary note, the industry has made extraordinary claims about this program that is going to lead to job losses, that it's going to lead to certain price rises, that they may have to leave the state. And I think time after time after time, we've found that the industries affected have exaggerated the numbers, the impact, in order to slow things down. And we just see that in the in the aviation industry, which is actually slowly beginning to have to start paying for the emissions in airplane flights, predicted everything from like $30 to $40 to $50 increases in tickets, and as a way to try to scare off the system. This is in the European Union, and now it turns out to be more like $5, which is still something, but it's far less. And if you look at chemical regulations, greenhouse gas regulations, there are generally far more excited and exaggerated claims at the outset than actually turn out to be the case.
And David, you looked at this. What did you find?
Well, unfortunately, this is one of those situations where there's a lot of studies out there, and basically, it's hard to find one that is not in some way biased. I mean, the studies more or less will line up with whoever paid for the study. Some of the there was a report that came out backed by some of the business groups here in California that said that cap and trade combined with a couple of the other greenhouse gas fighting regulations we have would be pretty disastrous, would cut our gross state product by 5.6% by 2020, wipe out something like 260,000 jobs or so. The state's own study of cap and trade and the other programs for greenhouse gases basically said it wasn't going to have a noticeable net effect at all, one way or another, positive or negative, by 2020. You know, it's hard to say in advance. I know some of the companies that have already had to deal with this in Europe will come out and say, yeah, this is not that big a problem. I was at a speech months ago by the president of Shell Oil, who was asked about this by a member of the audience there, and he said, you know, we already operate refineries and other facilities in Europe where they have the system in place. We're profitable. It's not a problem. So I personally do not know exactly what to tell you on this in terms of what to expect.
And so where does this – I know we have to let you go in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. What's next in terms of reporting? What questions are you still trying to answer?
Well, the one that I've mentioned a couple of times, exactly where the money goes.
Right.
That's sort of the big thing. That's going to be developing more, I think, over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks or so. There's a lot of movement on this. I'm just, as a reporter, I'm kind of astonished that we got to the first auction without this actually being in place.
Yeah, who's in charge of this?
Well, the system was set up and is more or less managed by the California Air Resources Board. They are an extremely powerful government organization that a lot of people are just not aware of at all. But essentially, they're the air pollution regulators for California. And they have spent the last 6 years putting this thing together with an awful lot of thought and work. They've done, I think, everything they can do to make the system work. We'll see now if it does.
Well, David, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
David Baker is a staff reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and he has been writing a series on this new cap-and-trade program. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And we've got about 10 more minutes with Mark Shapiro. He's been writing about this. He's done extensive reporting for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He also does a lot of reporting on climate change. And if you'd like to weigh in on this issue, if you have questions about it, and if anything struck you in the coverage, it's the number is 866-798-8255. We've got just about 8 minutes left. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's next hear from Peter in Santa Cruz. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. This is a question for Mark. Mark, how are they going to address the threat that power producers are just going to move over the border to Arizona and Nevada and then ship the energy over here, but we'll still get the pollution without the cap and trade being taken care of in California?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, and it's something that obviously is on the minds of people who put this program together. I think what California has that smaller states don't have is a huge economy, and it's a huge important state, and you can't ultimately just start moving massive quantities of production outside of the state. And I think it would be quite different, for example, if it was the situation was reversed, whether you had Arizona and California, number one. Number two, the nature of the power itself, I mean, a lot of power is generated from within California, and you can't just simply go buying power from other states, because then that states are already selling power to other states. In other words, we are still within the United States of America, and it's a large California is a large state. So I think it's actually the size of California itself is going to kind of mitigate against that situation.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Peter. But do you think that will happen?
I think more to the point that, you know, look, it's conceivable that basically manufacturers, I think, but more when it comes to kind of manufacturers or refiners could theoretically switch their production from California to Arizona or Utah or wherever it is. That is theoretically possible. But then what you have is a situation where you have extra transport costs. So how do you get the goods that you're going to sell in California from that state to California? So it all becomes part of the calculation. Look, this could happen, which is another reason why we need a national level program.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Peter. Let's go next to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul.
Yes, I think this is probably a related matter, which is this. Recently, I've read a story of all places, the Independent Journal of Marin County, which is the first place I saw this story, where a man wanted to find out whether the claims by the oil companies that the cost of gasoline was determined by shutdowns of refineries, blah, 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 the Chevron explosion. And he traced the real story by going over the emissions records that have to be filed with a government agency. And he found that there was no change week to week, month to month, during the times that they claimed that production had to be shut down. And that in the month of May, it cost the consumers in California over $1 billion of additional costs at the pump, and there was no shortage. There was no reduction in production, as they say, and it was the Independent Journal that wrote that story, and I've only seen casual mentions in other media, including the one I'm listening to right now.
Well, you brought it up, so thank you. Now we all know it exists. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, that's kind of interesting. If I understand what you said, that this piece described the shifts in gasoline prices as actually being disconnected from the supply-demand equation. I think that's what you're saying. And if I understand that, I think that's actually pretty interesting. It's always been mystifying to me when the price goes up and down. Certainly has a lot to do with the priorities of the oil companies at certain times. I don't claim to be an expert on this question. The only point I would make is that time and time again, I think it's been found that when oil interests as well as other major interests claim that state environmental policies are going to cost X, you go back 2, 3, 4 years down the line, and actually you realize the costs were far less than they predicted. Mm. And I would keep that in mind now when we hear about the claims of the costs of this program, and keep in mind that in almost every case, the costs have been far less than have been predicted.
And we talked about oil severance tax on our show about the California supermajority yesterday. Kind of related.
Good timing.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for the call, Raul. And let's go next to Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just praying that climate change activists will get empowered and start rejecting these kinds of solutions that are actually brought to us by corporations, such as oil companies, such as the Rockefellers and Chevron. Climate One is supported by Chevron. That's another. Many of these climate change organizations are cropping up, and they're supported by oil companies. And the whole thing about these solutions is it puts the onus of climate change on the ordinary citizen's footprint, and never is mentioned that the military burns two-thirds of the fossil fuels, as well as the mitigation. One of the things that will be covered for this, the funds will be going to people for mitigating, so-called mitigating of global warming, which one of the main things that is being talked about is geoengineering by Ken Caldiera and David Keith. And this has, you know, putting aerosols in to screen the sun. That is one of the techniques. Thank you very much for taking my call. Thank you.
I think the caller raises some multi-leveled questions here. Excuse me. But number one is, ironically, I would actually point out that the military, whatever your feelings about the military at any point or other, in fact, ironically enough, the military is actually at the forefront of actually trying to devise ways that are far more efficient fuel usage and is devising some really interesting strategies when it comes to greater efficiency and less reliance on fossil fuels. And so I think, ironically enough, we're going to have to look to the military for some of the ideas that are coming out in an interesting way. Number two, I think one of the things that's actually missing, and I think you're obliquely referring to, is the nature that the cap-and-trade system itself, how effective it actually is, and what are the interests behind it at this point. And I think there's no question that it's a system that has been devised to draw in some of the major economic interests of the state, and the question of whether it is the most efficient way to wean us off of fossil fuels is really a very high question. And this is a whole other discussion as to how the system itself works.
Yeah, and we will have that discussion. And again, I mean, the military is the world's largest polluter, to be clear.
Yes, yes.
But as you said, they have massive climate change programs.
Yes, yes. So it's an interesting double edge to this question.
Right. That would actually also be a good show.
That would be very interesting with the military. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. Also, the documentary that you were in that aired on KQED, what's that called?
It's called Heat and Harvest.
Yes, that's one we really would like to do a show about. It focuses on food in the Central Valley, so be sure to check that out. Mark Shapiro is an investigative journalist. He's written for a number of publications and specializes on these issues. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you for your phone calls and emails, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What has Superstorm Sandy revealed about relief efforts? On the next Jor Call, we'll have a conversation about the largest relief effort in U.S. history. Tens of thousands of residents at the end of subway lines are still in dire need of help. So what role has the government played? And what about Occupy Sandy? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What can we learn from relief efforts in order to prepare for the next earthquake? And what are the best organizations to support? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI, with Doc Away in Germany, I'll be joined by some of the big winners in the recent election, including Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown and incoming Texas Congressman, the twin brother of the mayor of San Antonio, Joaquin Castro. Our post-election special next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
Smiley and West this afternoon at 1 o'clock following the Tavis Smiley Show at noon here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco, online, KALW.org. Stay tuned next from the World Service of the BBC. It's World Have Your Say.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Nuala McGovern. You want to talk about Israel and Gaza?
Israel will continue to exercise this prudence and self-restraint while defending our citizens against terrorism.
I think that Israel knows that peace can only come via peace.
Leaders speak as the sound of airstrikes continue in Gaza. Chances of a ceasefire seem bleak. Since Israel assassinated Hamas's military chief on Wednesday, at least 20 Palestinians and 3 Israelis have been killed. And the war of words between Palestinians and Israelis has been bitter. This hour, you're going to hear two different conversations. The debates taking place between Israelis and those happening between Palestinians. Do post your question at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay.